Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
People started disappearing.
The Guzman just fell out of a helicopter.
Uh-oh, what's going on here?
The $6 billion gold scam from the BBC World Service and CBC.
Money is very, very dangerous.
Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Mars, and at 13 hours GMT on Friday, the 31st of May, these are our main stories. There's been a furious reaction among US Republicans after Donald Trump was found guilty of falsifying business records. Kuala Lumpur Airport is crammed as thousands of would-be guest workers are trying to have their documents processed ahead of a deadline in Malaysia. Coalition talks are expected to get underway in South Africa after an inconclusive election, the first in three decades. Also in this podcast, we'll have a special report from Mexico, where voters are almost certain to choose the first female president on Sunday.
The biggest challenge for the winner lies ahead in undoing centuries of sexism, gender inequality and violence in one of the most patriarchal societies in the Americas.
All that, and the New York Times takes legal action against attempts to register a game with a similar name to the online game Wordle. On the East Coast of America, the morning news shows are still buzzing with speculation after Donald Trump's guilty verdicts in New York on Thursday. He's become the first US president, former or serving, to be convicted of a criminal offence, falsifying business records to cover up a hush money payment to the adult film actress Stormy Daniels. His conviction, which he's likely to appeal, does not disqualify him from running in this November's presidential election, even if he's sent to prison when he's sentenced in July. The BBC's John Sudworth is following the story in New York.
Guilty!
In a nearby park, Mr. Trump's opponents celebrated. While inside the court, the former president was making history as the first ever to be convicted of a crime.
This was a disgrace. This was a rigged trial by a conflicted judge who was corrupt. It's a rigged trial, a disgrace. They wouldn't give us a venue change.
But it was a jury who convicted him on the evidence. 34 counts of falsifying business records to disguise hush money payments to the porn star Stormy Daniels, for the purpose, prosecutors said, of keeping her claim that they'd had sex from the American public just ahead of the 2016 election.
The whole thing, we didn't do a thing wrong. I'm a very innocent man.
The verdict brought only gloom to Mr. Trump's supporters, who were left repeating those claims of political persecution.
You know, the rulers use their powers to go after their political opponents. And they're afraid of a much more popular opponent, which they know will defeat them.
But this was a decision made by 12 ordinary New Yorkers, your fellow citizens. There's nothing political about that, is there?
I'm not going to say that the jury was tainted, but who knows?
So despite the sense of despondency amongst the Trump supporters, it's all pretty good-natured here, although there's a pretty large police presence just in case. The bigger question, though, is what the reaction's going to be longer term, with America now in uncharted territory.
Remember, we're going to win. We're all winners. We're going to win so big, we're going to make it bigger and better than ever before. Remember that.
What effect will it have on his candidacy? Will it put those crucial, undecided voters off or draw them to him? And what about the impact of his attacks on America's institution, already intensifying in the wake of the verdict, with his campaign releasing an advert calling him a political prisoner?
Good evening. First and foremost, I want to thank the jury for its service.
The man who brought the case, Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg, insisted the result was a sign the justice system is working.
While this defendant may be unlike any other in American history, we arrived at this trial and ultimately today at this verdict in the same manner as every other case that comes through the courtroom doors, by following the facts and the law and doing so without fear or favor.
Mr. Trump will be sentenced in early July and is unlikely, legal experts say, to go to jail. Either way, though, one half of a divided country now has a convicted criminal as its candidate.
John Sudworth. We heard Donald Trump protesting his innocence there and calling the judge corrupt. He said the trial was rigged and called the ruling a disgrace. He'll almost certainly appeal, a process that could take months or even longer. For the sentencing on July the 11th, the judge will have several factors to consider, including Donald Trump's age. The sentence could involve a fine, probation or supervision, or possibly prison time. My colleague Nick Robinson spoke to Shanlon Wu, a former US federal prosecutor, and he asked him about the slim possibility he could be sent to jail.
I would say it seems a little bit unlikely. The New York system for determining a sentence leaves a lot of discretion to the judge, and normally judges take into account if there's a criminal history, and he does not have a criminal history. But something to consider in terms of whether the sentence could be harsh enough to include prison time is during the trial, we may recall that he had a lot of outspoken issues that violated the gag order. The judge was not very happy about that and did not actually do anything at the time. And that can be factored in when it comes to the sentencing, as well as the fact that there are actually three other cases involving felonies, two federal ones and one state one in Georgia, that are still pending. So even though this is a defendant now convicted who has no previous criminal convictions, he does have a simultaneous contemporaneous criminal history right now.
So the criticism of the trial process, the attacks on the judge, might just persuade that judge to send him to prison, you think?
Well, it might. The judge has seemed pretty even-keeled, so I don't think he'll take it too personally. But I think the judge was very offended by what he felt is Trump's lack of respect for the system. It's very unusual for a defendant to mount these kinds of attacks on people, the judge's family, the prosecutor. I mean, it's unprecedented in some ways because most defendants, you know, don't want to be hurting themselves that way, shooting themselves in the foot, insulting the judge. But it also reveals a lot of contempt for the system and a lot of disrespect for it. And I think the judge did not like that.
Trump's attorneys say that they will appeal. They insist that he could never have got a fair trial under that judge and in that location in Manhattan, in other words. What prospects are there of that appeal being successful?
I think on those prospects, very, very poor. The idea that the jurisdiction is, you know, too liberal to give him a fair trial, that's really going nowhere. You almost could never win with that. You'd have to be using statistics like how many Democrats are there in the jurisdiction. That's just going no place fast. And the way that the judge conducted the trial was very fair, so I don't think they're going to make much headway with that. They may have a couple of more interesting legal issues to argue on appeal, such as the way that the prosecution combined the falsification of business records with an election interference charge. That's relatively novel. There's some permutations of that before, but these exact circumstances, first time that it's happened. So they might be able to do something with that when you combine it with the idea that maybe the definitions, the so-called instructions given to the jury might be challenged to say, oh, you caused this to be too confusing and maybe they got it wrong. So they might have, you know, some traction there. But things like saying New York is too liberal to get a fair trial or this judge was very biased against him, the record is just not going to support that at all.
That was the former U.S. federal prosecutor Shanlon Wu speaking to Nick Robinson. So how will all this impact Donald Trump's running for the White House this November? I got the latest from our correspondent in New York, Neda Torfik.
Really, we're seeing the reaction very much down partisan lines. Give you a sense of the papers here today. The New York Post, a conservative tabloid, decrying the verdict as an injustice and a political hit job, whereas other papers such as the New York Times emphasizing Donald Trump guilty on all counts. So you can see that Donald Trump and his conservative allies are really in full damage control mode. They've taken to social media, to the airwaves, to hit at the judge, claiming he's conflicted, that the jury was made up of all liberals, and calling for revenge. And we've just had a Truth Social post by Donald Trump. He's saying that this was a witch hunt, a common claim by Donald Trump. But it's interesting to see him end his post by saying, if this can happen to me, it can happen to anyone. Donald Trump and the Republicans are trying to make this about an attack on his supporters to try to rally them and others ahead of the election.
Very interesting. Are you getting a sense that there might be some worried Democrats thinking that it might give Mr. Trump a boost come November?
Look, I think nobody knows what could happen. Never before, it's unprecedented to have a convicted felon represent a major party before an election as tight as this. I think Democrats now are trying to figure out their messaging. How heavily do they lean into attacking Donald Trump? Or how much do they stick with, talking about abortion, talking about the threat to democracy if Donald Trump gets in to the White House? I think there's going to be a mix. We are still months out, and so they're going to hope that voters still remember this verdict, and it doesn't lose its power. But certainly for Democrats, they don't want to see people questioning the criminal justice system and buying into Donald Trump's lines of attack.
And briefly, Neda, it will stay in the public eye. There's possibly going to be an appeal. There will be a sentencing.
That's right. Donald Trump is saying he wants to appeal this. His lawyers have promised that. That will be a long process that will go past Election Day. But yes, Donald Trump is going to be sentenced July 11th, just days before he is crowned officially as the Republican nominee at the Republican convention. So this will continue to dog Donald Trump.
Neda Torfik in New York. Now to Kuala Lumpur. And that is the sound of the airport in the Malaysian capital, where thousands of foreign migrant workers are attempting to get their documents processed before Saturday, as the government will no longer approve new arrivals from then. I asked our Asia-Pacific editor, Mickey Bristow, more about that deadline.
Yeah, that sound there sounds like any busy airport, doesn't it? But actually, if you see the video of hundreds and hundreds of people sat on the ground, crowding corridors, crowding waiting areas, just essentially waiting for their papers to be processed, for themselves to have a health check, to get inside Malaysia. Now, you alluded to that deadline. Now, that's today, Friday, May the 31st, when the Malaysian government has said afterwards it will accept no more guest workers or migrant workers into the country. That's because it hopes to carry out some kind of assessment. There are already 2 million migrant workers, or more than 2 million migrant workers, inside the country. The government wants to assess to see how many more the economy might need before allowing any more in. So that's led to a big rush of people trying to get in just before this deadline.
Yeah, less than 4 hours to go, 8 o'clock in the evening in Malaysia now. We're hearing that quite a lot of people really clearly have just left it too late, haven't they?
Yeah, there are apparently in Bangladesh, the Bangladeshis make up the majority of people, migrant workers in Malaysia. There are about 350,000, I think, last year. 30,000 migrant workers in Bangladesh who have their papers in order to start work in Malaysia haven't been able to get a flight to Kuala Lumpur to actually get in. So they're probably going to be left behind. And lots of other countries as well, Nepal, Indonesia. Workers from there are not going to be able to get in as well. And it's really a reflection partly of the attraction and allure you have of Malaysia, one of the richest countries in Southeast Asia. Lots of people from poorer countries want to go there to work, and they're just not going to be able to go in there, at least for the short time while the government assesses how many more it needs.
Mickey Bristow. For more than 2 years, Ukraine has been using weapons given to it by its supporters. But allies like the United States and the EU have put restrictions on how those weapons can be used because they don't want to risk broadening the conflict. Well, now a key moment has arrived as Ukraine is being told it can now use US weapons to attack Russian positions in Russia itself, but again, with strict limitations. President Zelensky has hailed the US decision as a step forward. Our correspondent in Kyiv is Jean McKenzie.
This is something that the US has been mulling over, President Biden deciding that Kyiv is now allowed to use the weapons that it provides to strike into Russian territory, as you've been saying. But the restrictions are that it must be along this border of the Kharkiv region that borders the Belgorod region in Russia, because this is where Russia's latest offensive has been, and it is where the Ukrainians have been struggling to defend themselves. So just a couple of weeks ago, the Russian troops came over the border into the Kharkiv region. They took villages, and they are continuing to attack this part of northeastern Ukraine from Belgorod. So from Russia, they are able to launch missiles and artillery into the region. And the Ukrainians have been saying, look, there is nothing that we can do about this, really. Until these missiles and these bombs enter Ukrainian territory, we're not allowed to sort of strike. And that has really frustrated Zelensky, who has basically been arguing that his troops are having to fight with one arm behind them. But what the US are saying is that they cannot use US weapons on any of the other fronts in this war, right? And they also can't use the US long-range missiles that have been provided, which would be able to strike deep into the heart of Russian territory.
Jean McKenzie. Well, NATO foreign ministers are continuing their two-day meeting in the Czech capital, Prague. So how have they been reacting to what's being said in the US? Rob Cameron is in Prague.
Well, we were watching the arrivals of the foreign ministers to Černín Palace, the headquarters of the Czech foreign ministry, this morning. And I was taking notes of the Swedish, the Latvian, the Estonian, the Dutch, the Polish and indeed the Czech ministers as they came in. And they all said, look, this may be something new and revolutionary for Washington, but we've been doing it all along. We've never had restrictions, never placed restrictions that would stop Ukraine from using the weapons that we give Kyiv, even inside Russia. The Czech foreign minister briefed journalists, and he said, look, if Russian planes are launching rockets from Russian airspace and destroying Ukrainian cities, surely it makes sense to bring down the planes rather than try and bring down the rockets, as long as that can be done within the boundaries of international law under Article 51 of the United Nations Charter, and with a sense of logic if that is to be applied. So a very, very united line from the foreign minister, with the exception of a few states, chief among them Italy, probably the biggest country in NATO that is against, and of course Hungary and Slovakia, which have always opposed any NATO military aid or any individual military aid to Ukraine.
Rob, it looks as though Germany has said it's giving permission to Ukraine to fire its weapons on targets in Russia. Meanwhile, the Kremlin has been saying, look, US weapons are already being used to target Russia as it is. So it looks as though Russia has sort of baked this into to its expectations.
Yes, and there has, of course, been some reaction from Russia. The most outspoken comments, as we've come to get used to, is from the former president, Dmitry Medvedev, who said that that this announcement or this news from Washington showed that weapons provided by NATO and NATO countries had been used against Russia all along. He said that Moscow was not bluffing about the possible use of tactical nuclear weapons, and that any use of long-range weapons inside Russia would mean war between Russia and NATO. I think it should be said, though, that most policymakers, most officials, at least in the sort of public debate, frankly, regard Mr. Medvedev as a bit of a clown. He was always making these incredibly inflammatory statements, constantly threatening the use of nuclear weapons in retaliation. And he's done that from the outset, ever since Russia invaded Ukraine. So I think that most Western policymakers will not be taking those threats too seriously.
Rob Cameron in Prague. Coming up on the Global News Podcast. We go to Canada to hear how an Indigenous politician has been able to address the regional parliament in his own language for the first time. South Africa's ruling party, the African National Congress, is on course to lose its majority in Parliament for the first time since it came to power 30 years ago. Turnout for the general election was high, with a last-minute surge, but the votes have now been counted and the results are being audited. Barbara Pledasha is our correspondent in Johannesburg. I asked her if the situation on the ground looks like bad news for the ANC.
It does, yes, although the ANC is not admitting that. They're still vowing that they will get a majority. But I'm looking at the results dashboard right now, in real, where you get the results in real time, and that is not what it's looking like. It's 56.34% audited the vote, and at this stage, the ANC has around 42% of the vote. The main opposition party, the Democratic Alliance, which is a right-of-center pro-business party, has about 23-24%. Then this is interesting, the MK party, which was formed in December by the former president Jacob Zuma, basically as a challenge to the ANC, has 11%. So it's the third highest number of votes so far. And then the Economic Freedom Fighters, another group led by a former ANC figure, has about 9.5%. And these last two, the MK and the EFF, quite radical left-wing policies in terms of the economics of the country. I mean, both of them advocate expropriating land without compensation for the use of the people, as they put it. So you have quite an interesting breakdown of percentages and different ideologies.
So it does look, perhaps, the ANC is not admitting this, but it looks as though a coalition might have to be formed. What are the options for the ANC?
Well, one of the options could be for the ANC to form a coalition with smaller parties, with a number of smaller parties who would demand less compensations. I think that's looking less and less likely as it becomes clear that the ANC probably is not going to get above 45%, but I don't think that's been ruled out. The other option then would be that they would have to form an alliance with one of those three that I mentioned, either on the right, the Democratic Alliance, but they're quite different ideologically from the ANC, or on the left with either the MK or the Economic Freedom Fighters, or both. And again, that would be more of a natural fit because both of those parties have connections previously to the ANC. But as I said, they have quite radical policies that would make it complicated for the ANC. So, you know, it's quite unpredictable. We really don't know what sort of coalition could be formed.
Barbara Plett-Usher. So why have some South Africans fallen out of love with the ANC? Here's our correspondent in Durban, Nomsa Maseko.
People are quite disillusioned by promises made but not kept by the governing African National Congress. In fact, just a few minutes ago, I just came back from the community of Verulam, which is a 20-minute drive from the Durban city centre. And that community has not had running water for 10 months. And they are saying that they've been waiting, for the ANC, because that's the councillor of that community, to fix the water problem. But because that has not happened, they then decided to vote against the ANC in this election because they felt that the ANC was not taking them serious in terms of making sure that services are delivered to the people.
Nomsa Maseko in Durban. Mexicans head to the polls on Sunday in a historic election. Both the front runner, the former mayor of Mexico City, Claudia Sheinbaum, and the main challenger are women, meaning Mexico is almost certain to choose its first female president. But what impact will that have in a nation with deeply embedded problems of machismo and sexual violence against women and girls? Our Mexico correspondent, Will Grant, reports from the campaign trail in the eastern state of Veracruz.
As Claudia Sheinbaum arrives for a rally in a packed park in the colonial city of Orizaba, the crowd chants, Presidenta, Presidenta. Polls suggest that's what she's on the brink of becoming, Mexico's first ever woman president. With her closest rival also a woman, Mexico is set to break centuries of male domination of the country's highest office.
It's a symbol for Mexico. I think it's a symbol for the world, but it's a symbol for Mexico.
In an exclusive interview, Ms. Sheinbaum told the BBC it's a sign that Mexican society is finally evolving.
Mexicans are now governed by many women. I see it in young girls. They are exciting that a woman is going to be president. And it changed culture for women and for men. And you have to develop policies to reduce violence for women.
Vamos con información. En Veracruz, hayan a joven sin vida.
That is easier said than done in a country where 11 women are murdered a day.
Isamar Galindo Romero, de 23 años, fue hallado sin vida.
Just days before the candidates visit to Veracruz, the body of 23-year-old Isamar Galindo was found tortured, wrapped in a blanket and dumped in a canal.
What
real difference will it make, though, if you don't address those issues?
I put it to Claudia Sheinbaum that the question of whether a man or a woman is in charge will matter little if such ingrained problems of machismo in Mexico remain the same. She replied that profound cultural changes don't happen overnight, and if elected, she said she'll continue the process of social and political change begun by her mentor, President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who's more commonly known by his initials as AMLO. Their supporters call the political project the fourth transformation of Mexico.
The objective of the government is changing the model, the economic model, and is changing also for women. I'm going to tell you something that indigenous women told me in Los Altos de Chiapas. I will try to translate it. You are the not accomplished dream of our grandmothers.
Do you feel quite a lot of responsibility on your shoulders when women tell you those sorts of things in Mexico, in remote towns?
I feel responsibility because I'm going to be the next president of Mexico, of course. Mexico ya
despertó! The BBC requested an interview with Ms. Sheinbaum's main rival, Xochitl Galvez, but she declined. As Galvez's key criticism of the so-called fourth transformation is that President López Obrador's social spending is unaffordable and that his entire political project is a personality cult. As for Ms. Sheinbaum, she accuses her of being merely AMLO's puppet, something the former environmental scientist firmly denies.
Of course I'm of the same movement with López Obrador. We fought together for more than 20 years. I'm going to govern with the same principles, and that's a good thing. La
primera! The other main chant at Claudia Sheinbaum's events is Primera, meaning the first. But a woman president in Mexico is hugely significant and long overdue. Still, the biggest challenge for the winner lies ahead, in undoing centuries of sexism, gender inequality and violence in one of the most patriarchal societies in the Americas.
Will Grant reporting from Mexico. Now, history was made in Canada this week when an indigenous lawmaker addressed a provincial parliament in his own language for the first time. Sol Mamakwa, a New Democratic Party member for the community of Kingfisher Lake First Nation, has been speaking to the BBC about the experience. Stephanie Prentice has this report.
A major milestone for Indigenous Canadians. Sol Mamakwa making a formal address in his own language, saying he was speaking for those who couldn't. It's the first time a language other than English and French has ever been permitted in the chamber. His family were there to support him, with some flying hours to get there, but he was still uncertain at first.
I got this weird feeling at the beginning, probably about 30 seconds in, you know, what am I doing? Am I going to get stopped? And about a minute into it, I got comfortable. But also the First Nations people, the leadership, the elders, my family that were there, they were so moved.
In the past, lawmakers have been stopped when speaking their own language during formal proceedings. For them, a familiar experience.
When I was in grade 9, 13 years old, we were punished for speaking our language and we were given very hard labor. And there's so other stories that were given to me by other survivors, and that said, you know, they were, soap was used to clean out their mouths because they were speaking their language.
There are more than 70 distinct Indigenous languages in Canada, and the United Nations has said all of them are at risk. Sol Mamakwa says he's committed to fighting for the identity of all Indigenous people, with a special message for Indigenous children.
I think it's important to be proud of who they are, be proud of the language that they speak, because languages are part of the healing that we need to do. And today, language was reconciliation.
That report was by Stephanie Prentice. The New York Times, which owns the hit game Wordle, has filed a legal challenge against attempts to register a game with a very similar name, created as a hobby by a man in Seattle. Players of Wordle, hard to say, have to identify the precise location of a photo taken from Google's Street View. But the paper says the name causes confusion. Our technology editor, Zoe Kleinman, takes up the story.
Wordle became popular in 2022, and the New York Times acquired the word game for a seven-figure sum. One of its millions of players was Corey McDonald, a software developer in Seattle who was inspired to set up Wordle in his spare time. Mr. McDonald says that while the name is no coincidence, there are many other similar-sounding games out there, such as Hurdle, Nerdle and Quaddle. But the New York Times is opposing his attempt to register Wordle. He says he'll fight the legal opposition and hopes it could set a precedent for others in future. But one expert said because Mr. McDonald's game name was different by just one letter, he could be sailing close to the wind. The New York Times declined to say whether it was pursuing any other titles.
Zoe Kleinman. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was produced by Alice Adderley and was mixed by Daniel Fox. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.